They're not going to shut up Navarro. They're not going to shut up Bannon, and they're certainly not going to shut up MAGA. There's nothing that can shut me up and nothing that will shut me up.
Oh, shut up, Bannon. Thank you.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's one reason.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
You know what I
mean? I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950, KTNF, amongst other fine terrestrial affiliates. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-round swell fellow, says me and everyone I know, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Good to have you with us. We got a lot to get to today, including a guest joining us momentarily. So, Des, you still feeling good?
Yes, I am. Thank you for asking.
No further COVID rebound since we last talked?
No, my adventure with COVID appears to be over for now.
For now. Wish you hadn't added that part. Anyway, glad you're feeling better. Let's start here. Steve Bannon, former publisher of the far-right Breitbart propaganda outlet, turned 2016 Donald Trump campaign manager, turned senior Trump White House political advisor, turned federally indicted and then pardoned by Trump grifter, and then indicted and convicted for contempt of Congress criminal. Well, he's finally going to prison. Maybe. Or at least as far as I can tell, maybe not anytime actually soon, despite what you may have seen. I don't know. We'll see. All of this according to a Trump-appointed federal judge on Thursday, despite Bannon's yelling and screaming about how the Justice Department has been weaponized against him under Joe Biden. Steve Bannon, a longtime ally of former President Donald Trump, must report to prison by July 1. To serve his four-month sentence for defying a subpoena from the bipartisan House committee that investigated the U.S. Capitol insurrection. That, according to a federal judge on Thursday, U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols, appointed to the federal bench by Donald Trump in 2019, granted prosecutors' request in Washington on Thursday to make Bannon begin serving his prison term after a three-judge panel of a federal appeals court last month upheld his contempt of Congress conviction. But, and this could be a pretty big but Nichols, Judge Nichols, also made clear in his ruling that Bannon could seek a stay of his order, which could delay his surrender date. Because of the panel's ruling on the appellate court, Judge Nichols said he no longer believes that Bannon could rightfully continue to postpone serving his sentence. Lawyers for Bannon have promised to ask the full D.C. Court of Appeals, rather than just that three-judge panel, the full court to reconsider the three-judge panel's decision. And Judge Nichols said that Bannon would nonetheless have to start serving his sentence in less than 4 weeks unless that full appeals court took the case and issued its own ruling to pause the sentence from being enforced. Got it?
I think so.
The judge's decision, according to the New York Times, seemed to catch Bannon's lawyer, David Schoen, by surprise, and he approached the podium after it was issued and started arguing with the judge, who dressed him down.
Yeah.
Judge Nichols said, quote, "One thing I think you need to learn as a lawyer is that when a judge has decided, you do not get up and yell at them." Outside the courthouse, Bannon was doing plenty of yelling at reporters, saying, quote, "I've got great lawyers and we're going to go all the way to the Supreme Court if we have to." Of course, if he does, and if the corrupted Supremes accept his application to be heard there, even if they don't ultimately agree with him, it could hold up the entire matter until Donald Trump could become president again. And then, of course, pardon Steve Bannon a second time for federal crimes. Judge Nichols had initially allowed Bannon to remain free while he fought his conviction, but the panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for D.C. Circuit said that all of Bannon's challenges lack merit. But since when has that ever stopped the packed and stolen and corrupted high court from doing favors for their Republican friends in the past? Am I too cynical? Bannon was convicted back in 2022 of two counts of contempt of Congress here, one for refusing to sit for a deposition with the January 6 House committee and the other for refusing to provide documents to them related to his involvement in Trump's efforts to steal the 2020 election, the one that he lost to Joe Biden. Bannon's lawyer at the trial back in 22 had argued that the charges were politically motivated and made other claims, all of which did not fly at the trial that was overseen by the Trump-appointed judge. Neither did those claims fly during the appeal, at least so far. But Bannon and his attorneys are still going to choke that chicken as long as they possibly can. The defense attorney, Schoen, said it would be unfair to send Bannon to prison now because he would have already completed his four-month sentence before those rulings could be handed down. Now, another Trump aide, you may recall, trade advisor Pete Navarro, was also convicted of contempt of Congress for the very same two things, and he was ordered back in March to report to prison to serve his four-month sentence after being ordered to do so by a judge that was not appointed by Donald Trump. Navarro maintained he couldn't cooperate with the House J6 committee because Trump had invoked executive privilege, but the courts rejected that argument because Navarro actually had no evidence that Trump had ever invoked executive privilege. The House J6 committee's final report asserted that Trump criminally engaged in a, quote, multi-part conspiracy, unquote, to overturn the lawful results of the 2020 election and failed to act to stop his supporters from attacking the Capitol, concluding an extraordinary 18-month investigation into the former president and the violent insurrection 2 years ago. They completed their investigation 2 years ago when Republicans took back the majority in the House. Yet that committee was never able to receive documents from or to ask questions to Steve Bannon, despite the fact that the day before the Trump-incited insurrection at the Capitol, Bannon had promised on his War Room podcast that January 6th would be like nothing the nation had ever seen before, as if he knew something. So now what happens next? Well, that remains to be seen. The full D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals could quickly reject an appeal by Bannon in advance of his required July 1 report to prison date. Or they could accept the appeal but refuse to issue a stay on his sentence, or they could take the appeal and issue that stay. Or the Supreme Court, were they not entirely corrupted, they could do pretty much all of the same. But since when has this corrupted U.S. Supreme Court ever done the right thing when they didn't have to? He asks, as we still await the court's ruling on Donald Trump's argument that was rejected repeatedly and thoroughly by every lower court, that presidents have complete and total immunity from criminal law, even if, as you'll recall in that case, Trump's lawyers actually argued to the court that he should have immunity even if a president orders SEAL Team 6 to assassinate his political rival. Yes, the Supreme Court took up that dumb case, and we still do not have a ruling on that. We're waiting on that. We have been for months. And then, of course, that decision will come, in theory, by the end of this month. But it has nonetheless assured that Trump will not go to trial on federal charges related to his attempt to steal the 2020 election before he is allowed to stand for election yet again in 2024. We'll get to some other horrible decisions by our U.S. Supreme Court, both in recent years and going back about 50 of them, with my guest joining me momentarily, specifically bad decisions on voting rights, as the court has spent the last five decades undermining voting rights in this country, according to my guest, an election law expert. And also, we will have Desi Doyen's latest Green News report, which includes some landmark and, frankly, disturbing, if not entirely unexpected news this week from the EU's climate agency, Copernicus, finding that the planet has just marked what its Copernicus director called a, quote, shocking but not surprising new milestone, enduring 12 consecutive months of unprecedented heat, with every single month from June 23 to May 24 now being the hottest such month on record. Now, that news, which you'll have more details on in the GNR, also came on the same day that the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres made an impassioned speech in New York about climate change, slamming fossil fuel companies as, quote, the godfathers of climate chaos, charging that we are now on, quote, the highway climate to hell.
Highway to climate hell.
What did I say?
Highway to, I'm not sure what you said, but it wasn't that. He said we were on the
highway to climate hell. Right. And for the first time, and this is what I find interesting, he explicitly called on all countries to ban advertising of fossil fuel products, just like we have banned tobacco advertising, given the number of people who are killed by it each year. Same is true of fossil fuels. And, you know, while I know you're going to go into more details in your Green News report on the Copernicus numbers and the Guterres remarks about the fossil fuel industries, we didn't really get time to discuss his call for a ban on advertising by those companies, which have spent billions of dollars over decades, quote, according to Guterres, distorting the truth, deceiving the public, and sowing doubt. He called on every country to ban fossil fuels, just like bans implemented around the world for other products that harm human health, like tobacco. CNN reported on that, but they get a lot of their money from these companies.
Right.
There's one aspect they didn't mention about what Guterres said that in their coverage that Reuters did in theirs. Reuters says, drawing a comparison with many governments' restrictions on advertising for harmful substances like tobacco, quote, I urge every country to ban advertising from fossil fuel companies, and I urge news media and tech companies to stop taking fossil fuel advertising. Interesting that CNN left that part about him urging news media to just stop taking fossil fuel advertising money.
Interesting, but not surprising.
So as this is a new idea, at least to me, Des, I'm wondering what you think about it.
Well, I think it's a fantastic idea. Guterres not only called out, you know, news organizations and others who accept fossil fuel funding for big projects, you know, like museums. I get energy and environment-related newsletters in my email inbox every day, like, say, I don't know, from Axios. That are sponsored by Exxon and Chevron, touting how good they are, how hard they're trying. And it's really quite shocking to compare an email newsletter that says, hey, here's this really crazy new record that shows just how dangerous the climate crisis is, and then right below that, it's Exxon saying, we're trying really hard to bring you low-carbon fuels.
Saving the planet. You know, I mean, all of those advertisements They are nothing but what we call greenwashing, right?
Right. As Guterres pointed out, the fossil fuel industry is spending 2% of their capital investments on renewable energy. The rest go to more fossil fuels. And I think what's important about this is about revoking the social license of the fossil fuel industry. If you start making it so that they can't have this social license to operate when you're actually killing 7 to 8 million people a year around the world from air pollution, and you're also, you know, bringing us climate disaster, seems like that should be something that we should be paying attention to.
Yeah, well, or potentially banning. I mean, like I say, it's greenwashing. It's not like, you know, they say stuff in these ads like, oh, Shell has the best gas, or fill up your tank 10 times at ExxonMobil and the next tank is on us. No, they are all simply BP cares about the environment.
Oh, yeah.
Shell is doing this to keep our planet clean. They are all lies. And by the way, we do not need a law for any of this. God knows Republicans who accept millions of dollars from the fossil fuel industry. Trump just asked for billions, $1 billion, literally, from them in exchange for, he said he would dismantle all the climate-related laws if he's elected again. So God knows Republicans are not going to do it. Big media could simply refuse to take that advertising money from fossil fuel companies, that deadly money, frankly. And yeah, as you note, it's not just the big media outlets like CNN and Fox and MSNBC on all the major networks, but, you know, NPR takes money from these companies too.
Yep.
They could stop as well. All right. As noted, more on related matters in our GNR, which never accepts fossil fuel industry money.
True.
Then again, they never offered. Bradcast at bradblog.com. Shell Oil, if you're listening, just saying. Anyway, more on that later this hour. But first, while we've been, you know, raising hell about the climate for well over a decade, and the mainstream corporate media is only begrudgingly beginning to do so of late, we've also been yelling and screaming about the corrupt Supreme Court for a couple of decades now, particularly when it comes to election law and voting rights. And there was a time when I would argue to that end on bradblog.com, and I would hear back from academic, you know, law scholars and professors that I was impolitic in charging that the high court was corrupt and actively undermining American democracy. Good news? Those days seem to be over. As yes, the election law scholars and academics seem now to be charging the very same thing. One of them, Josh Douglas of the University of Kentucky, even has a brand new book about it out right now with the subtitle "The Troubling Story of How the Supreme Court Has Undermined Voting Rights." That professor will join us to discuss that book right after a quick break. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently, without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
That works.
I'm a fool to do your dirty work. Oh, yeah.
Sort of.
I don't want to do your dirty work no more.
Oh, we'll see about that.
I'm a fool to do your dirty work. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. University of Kentucky's constitutional election law professor Joshua Douglas begins the introduction to his brand new book called The Court Versus the Voters by describing his shock at the events as they unfolded at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, before noting that the Supreme Court rejected several frivolous lawsuits filed by Republicans that sought to call the legitimacy of the 2020 election into question. In that sense, the court stood for democracy. It refused to intervene to throw the election to the losing candidate. The court very well could have offered a forum for Donald Trump and his followers, but that would have been an obvious power grab that would have led to even further calamities. But the Supreme Court, he says, is not blameless for what happened that day. Douglas writes that the court's rulings over the past 50 years have actively undermined voting rights, showing that judicial decisions can impact election outcomes. Trump and his supporters latched onto the wild idea that certain state legislatures could overturn the election results by awarding him their electoral college votes, or that courts would simply do his bidding. Too many people thought it was possible for state legislatures to simply overturn the vote totals based on the notion that state legislatures have unfettered power in this area and that the constitutional right to vote is secondary. Now, where might so many people have come up with that notion? Well, Josh Douglas answers the question. Many of the Supreme Court's decisions over the past five decades have promulgated this crabbed view of voter rights. To understand the current crisis in American democracy, he explains, we need to focus on the Supreme Court, its decisions over the past 50 years. Many of the key ones, Douglas details in his new book, laid the foundation for Donald Trump and his supporters in Congress to call the 2020 presidential election into question despite a total lack of evidence that the outcome was ever in doubt. So, how exactly did those rulings, some of them dating back as far as the 1970s at the U.S. Supreme Court, lead us to the attempted toppling of our constitutional democracy on January 6, 2021? Well, let's ask Josh Douglas. Professor Joshua A. Douglas teaches and researches election law, voting rights, and constitutional law at the University of Kentucky College of Law. He's joined us on the program a number of times over the years, though it has been too long, frankly. His previous book, published back in 2019, as I recall, was called Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. But his newest book, The Court versus the Voters, has the subtitle The Troubling Story of How the Supreme Court Has Undermined Voting Rights. And yeah, it seems to offer a much grimmer take on our democracy and, yes, the past, current, and future of voting rights in the U.S. Professor Douglas, welcome back to the broadcast, sir, and congratulations on the new book.
Hey, Brad. Thanks for having me, and it's great to be back.
I've only just recently received a copy of the book, so I haven't been able to plow through much more than the introduction yet, to be frank. But you charge in it, in no uncertain terms, that, quote, the Supreme Court of the United States is anti-democracy and anti-voter and has been for far longer than you might think. Now, that's a pretty serious charge, Professor, the kind that when I would make such arguments, bradblog.com, let's say, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, I was dismissed by some constitutional election law experts and professors like yourself, not you personally, but other highly regarded academics of your ilk as, you know, a sort of a radical leftist loose cannon for daring to say as much. So I'm curious, Josh, how long have you been a radical leftist loose cannon like me? Or maybe the more polite way to ask that question is, was there something? Was there a decision? Was there a moment in time when you came to see SCOTUS as anti-democracy and anti-voter? Or have you always felt that way throughout your career?
Well, I think one thing to point out is that my work has, I strive in my work to be nonpartisan. Mm-hmm. I don't take political sides. I don't see myself as an ideologue or on the ideological spectrum in my public work. And mm-hmm. so the fact that I'm saying this as someone, you know, who's worked very closely, for example, with the Republican Secretary of State in my state of Kentucky mm-hmm. on pro-voter policies, you know, I've someone who believes that voting rules are not legitimate unless you have both sides at the table. I think if the Democrats are crafting voting rules unilaterally, it's just as bad as if Republicans are doing so, because I think legitimacy requires buy-in from everyone. So the fact that I make this statement about the Supreme Court as someone who has tried to be very nonpartisan in my work, I think says a lot, right, about how stark it's become with respect to the way in which the court has crafted or thought of the constitutional right to vote. Now, you asked if there's one case or, you know, one moment when I started to think this. It's really not. It's been a series of cases. And I think that, you know, you don't really recognize what's happened unless you take a 50-year retrospective. You know, each case by itself maybe doesn't seem that bad. There's no one case that's, you know, explicitly overturning precedent. The court's doing it in much more what it tries to show is incremental ways. But when you put them all together, the connective tissue is a trust of state politicians, the very people we should trust the least when it comes to voting rules.
Yes. And indeed, in the court versus the voters, you outline at least nine of these cases that you think that you argue taken together make this case. You write, quote, "A close analysis of the Supreme Court's rulings reveal that in a project that has spanned decades, the court has contributed to the rise of anti-democracy forces animating our elections." So how so? How have they done this? And as you review their key opinions on elections and voting rights matters, now going back some 50 years or so, has this been a concerted effort, presumably by the court's right wing, to undermine electoral democracy? Or has it happened as a sort of a matter of, you know, a death by a thousand cuts, or at least the nine major cuts that you document in your book over those past five decades?
Yeah, it was hard to choose just nine because there's been a lot of cases that have undermined the constitutional right to vote. And then chapter 10 is called the next looming case, where I try to essentially predict or provide some insight on where the court is going next. You know, the court, again, I don't think it's necessarily tried, at least when this began. And I talk about, you know, chapter one is a case from 1983 involving a guy named John Anderson and his run for president as an independent in 1980. And then I moved to a 1992 case called Burdick versus Takushi, which is about someone in Hawaii who wanted to write in a candidate. And the court there pulled back from the high water mark of rights protection in the 1960s, the, you know, so-called Warren Court that named after Chief Justice Earl Warren, where the court was very protective of lots of different rights, including the right to vote. You know, the court actually had not been very good on voting rights prior to the 1960s. So the 60s is really where we see very strong judicial protection for the constitutional right to vote. And the way the court did this was by making states really carefully and strongly justify their voting rules. You know, state would pass a law, say a poll tax that Virginia used to have. You had to pay a small fee to vote. And the court would scrutinize the state and put the state to its test to say, you know, why do you need this kind of law? What are the goals you're trying to achieve? And does this law actually achieve those goals? But in the 1970s and 1980s, as I mentioned, the Anderson case from 83, the Burdick case from 92, the court begins to pull back on this and start saying, well, states, we're going to sort of trust you. We're going to say, if you say that, you know, this law is to ease election administration, we're not going to probe that more carefully. And then you fast forward to 2008 and the Crawford decision about voter ID laws, where, you know, the states, that the court says, you know, why do you need a photo ID requirement for voting? And the state says, well, we're worried about voter fraud. And the court asks, well, do you have any evidence of this kind of fraud, that people are showing up to the polls and pretending to be someone they're not? And the state of Indiana says, no, we're just worried about it. And the court says, okay, that's enough. You know, just the fact that you're worried, even though on the plaintiffs on the other side had strong evidence that the law would actually disenfranchise some people. And so you see this slow march. And one thing is also really interesting. The justice who wrote that first case I mentioned, the Anderson case from 83, that was Justice John Paul Stevens, kind of a noted liberal. And in 92, when the court begins to pull even further away from this stronger judicial protection to instead one where we're going to trust the states. Stevens dissents in that case. So he no longer is following the very test that he initially had set out in that first case. So it has been death by a thousand cuts, as you put it. It's been a slow march, and there's no one, you know, case or one concerted effort. But again, the ultimate test here, the ultimate theory is that we're going to trust the state politicians to run elections as they want.
And by the way, also to Justice Stevens' credit, he also later in his career, or maybe it was after he was off the court, I can't remember, said we got it wrong when it came to the Crawford case and photo ID restrictions, that that was a mistake. And it's very rare that you hear a justice coming out and saying, because he was the guy, I think, who wrote the Crawford case originally, as I recall. He said,
yeah,
we were wrong.
Yeah, he did write the Crawford case. Now that one, you know, he was stuck with this test of we're going to give the state some more leeway in justifying its rules. But he was also stuck with three more conservative justices who wanted to uphold all photo ID laws forever. And so he wrote a compromise opinion in which he said, well, we're not going to reject Indiana's law, but we're going to leave the door open to future challenges if plaintiffs can bring better evidence. So there's kind of a lot of kind of interesting things going on with that voter ID case. But you're right. He ultimately then even said that that he thinks he got it wrong, or at least the test he set out, he thinks, was too lenient on the state at the expense of voters.
So we have seen this sort of slow erosion over the past several decades of what had been a standard of strict scrutiny to basically say, well, if you guys are worried about voter fraud, then, you know, go ahead and do what you want. You charge that the court's decisions over these years, quote, unduly defer to state legislators to craft election rules that help politicians stay in power while failing to protect voters. But as Republicans, Josh, have been arguing now for so many years, including in their attempts to overturn, I call it steal, the 2020 election, they argue that the Constitution gives state legislatures the ultimate power to determine the place and manner by which elections are held in each state, right? So why then is deferring to those legislatures undue, as you see it?
Well, they have two things wrong here. While it is correct that the Constitution delegates to state legislatures the power to determine the times, place, and manner of federal elections, that's Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution. That provision also says that Congress can make or amend those laws. So it actually gives power to federal Congress as above the state legislatures in crafting voting rules. So their power is not absolute, just in the just reading the text. State legislature's power is not absolute. The second thing they get wrong is that they forget that the Constitution has Article 3, which creates the judiciary, and as the Supreme Court has long held, includes the power of judicial review to review whether it's congressional laws or state laws. And we have this ideal in the Constitution of the Equal Protection Clause, this principle of equality, which the court has held means that when it comes to voting, we have to treat all voters equally, and essentially includes a constitutional right to vote. Now, I agree that the protection for voting rights could be much more explicit within the U.S. Constitution. State constitutions already have explicit protection for the constitutional right to vote. So all that means is that, you know, yes, state legislatures get the first cut at crafting voting rules, but it's not the final
right cut.
And that there, you know, has always been a tradition of judicial review of the courts ensuring that laws are not infringing upon important rights, including the right to vote. And, you know, you can go back to the Declaration of Independence, which says that a government is legitimate based on the consent of the governed, the consent of the governed. So what should that mean? It should mean that voters are paramount in our system, not state politicians.
And yet you will hear Republicans, I think more and more over the years that I've been on this beat, you know, arguing more and more frequently, well, there is no right to vote in the Constitution. using that to undermine really anything, anywhere they feel like bringing out that argument. I mean, I'm not an election attorney, but it seems to me over the years that the U.S. Supreme Court sort of picks and chooses which parts of the Constitution that it may favor at any given particular moment for any particular outcome that it may want. Usually, you know, when picking the part of the Constitution that ends up benefiting Republican politicians at any given time. And I should note, as you did, that when I cover elections, you know, I'm nonpartisan when it comes to election laws, and I'll go to bat for Republican, you know, for voters who are voting for Republicans just as much as I would for voters voting for Democrats. But we see decision after decision, including many in your book, but also, you know, others that didn't make your book, that seem to be just the right wing Republican appointees on the court sort of making it up as they go. Am I a radical leftist loose cannon for saying as much, Professor?
Well, you're right in that the court seems to pick and choose when it wants to elevate important principles. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Constitution should be the thing that's consistent. The principles are there, whether you like them or not. Mm-hmm. As I said before, I certainly think there could be better protection for the right to vote more explicitly within the U.S. Constitution. But just because it doesn't say there is a right to vote, doesn't mean it's not there. I mean, you know, the Constitution's rights are mostly written in the negative. It mm-hmm. says that the government can't infringe upon your right to free speech. It says the government cannot deny the right to vote on the basis of race or sex or inability to pay a poll tax or age of 18 or older. So there aren't a lot of places in the U.S. Constitution that actually affirmatively grant rights. So
right.
In that way, it's not surprising that there's no explicit grant of the right to vote. That doesn't mean the principle isn't there. And again, the U.S. Supreme Court used to recognize, and I mean, it still does to some extent today, although certainly not as strongly, but it recognizes the right to vote within the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And there's a important constitutional ideal there. You know, if the Constitution requires democracy, a democratic republic, I need to say that so we don't get into the nonsense
yes,
of it's a you know, republic, not a democracy.
Thank you.
It's both, of course, right? So if the Constitution contemplates setting up a system that is a democratic republic, then, of course, voting has to be and voters have to be paramount in that. And the court once did so by, again, saying that we need to very carefully scrutinize election rules. And, you know, we could go all the way back to this old case called Caroline Products and the famous footnote 4 of Caroline Products, which constitutional law scholars know this is a case from 1938, the most famous footnote in Supreme Court history, in which the court says normally we're going to defer to the legislatures because they have the expertise on things like, you know, health or economic policy. But when the political and if you don't like that those rulings, just vote the bums out, right? That's the solution. But when the political process or the issue is such that you can't vote the bums out, mm-hmm. then we need stronger court protection. So, you know, issues of race where you're dealing mm-hmm. with minority rights and the minorities are a minority, so they don't have a majority to vote the bums out. The political process isn't working. Same goes with voting laws. If, you know, the bums are crafting rules to help keep themselves in power, then there's really no answer to say, well, just vote the bums out.
Well, and that seems to be the problem here, is that they have been making it harder to vote the bums out, harder to change the law to protect the voters. You describe in your book the sordid history of the right to vote in this country, going back to our founding, which began by, you know, allowing only white men to vote at all, later added black men, at least in theory, if not necessarily in practice in many states, about 100 years later, thanks to a civil war, and then eventually, the right to vote was granted to women only by a constitutional amendment in 1920. Eventually, That happened. But a lot of blood was spilled along the way, both before and after, until we eventually get to the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965 and a decades-long subsequent effort by some heroic folks across the nation to enforce it, which was not and still is not easy to do. But is it fair to say then that the Voting Rights Act sort of it feels like it was the high watermark for the right to vote, at least in law in this country, and that really ever since we have now sort of been on a downslope with the high court piece by piece dismantling it in various ways over the years?
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, I would combine not only Congress passing the Voting Rights Act of 1965, but that era also included many of these Supreme Court cases that strongly protected voting rights. And ever since then, as I discuss in the book, it's mm-hmm. been a slow march yeah. towards dismantling some of the protections of the Voting Rights Act, as well as undermining the constitutional importance of the right to vote within the U.S. Constitution. And again, I don't think if you look at any one case, you necessarily see it.
Yeah.
I think it's when we look at these combined to note the way in which the court has placed the thumb on the scale of state legislatures at the expense of voters. Now, with respect to the Voting Rights Act itself, I do discuss two cases in the book, Shelby County, which a lot of people know about, which gutted the important Section 5 mm-hmm. that required certain jurisdictions to seek pre-clearance or pre-approval for their voting rules. That was the 2013 case. But I also talk about the 2021 case, Brnovich versus DNC, mm-hmm. involving another provision, Section 2. And this is a great example of the way in which the court has undermined voters. This is a challenge to some Arizona voting laws. And the plaintiffs had some evidence that these laws harmed minority voters. Some people disputed how strong the evidence was. And so it goes all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, you know, could have just rejected the claim and said, you know, you don't, you know, you didn't bring good enough evidence of the harms. But instead, Justice Alito, and I write this in the book, I said he made up the law.
Yep.
And how did he make up the law? Well, he said for a plaintiff to win a case under this provision, under Section 2, they need to satisfy 5 guideposts. Now, I don't know where he came up with these guideposts.
Right.
He had hardly any citations to any legal authority yep. in the section about the guideposts. And every single one of them will make it much harder for plaintiffs to bring a successful claim under the Voting Rights Act. So, I mean, he literally cut it from thin air. We talk about, you know, activist judges and, you know, people
yeah.
use that term a lot. And often it just means I didn't like the decision. Activist judge, in my view, is actually when you impose your own views without any sort of authority behind them, besides the fact that you have the robe. And that's exactly what Justice Alito did in that case when he came up with these 5 guideposts and said, these are the things now that plaintiffs have to satisfy
yep.
to win their case. And every one of them makes it hard for voters.
Yeah. And I got to say, there has been a lot of that since Brnovich, not necessarily in election law, but a lot of cases where the Supreme Court is just making stuff up out of whole cloth. And a lot of times it seems to be Alito there, but also Roberts. I mean, the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment comes to mind, the insurrectionist disqualification clause that they recently decided on, making up again out of whole cloth this sort of, you know, test and this notion that, well, that can only be applied to federal candidates if Congress has made a law explaining how to do that. There's no basis for that. They just made it up. And it kind of, you know, reminds me of your book here, where it's, you know, one decision may not be the end of the world, but that leads to another decision, to another decision, to another decision, each one sort of looking at the past decision and using that for a precedent as things get worse and worse. There have been a lot of bad rulings by what has been a Republican-dominated court for decades now. And again, not partisan, but I think it's important to point this out. How did you decide on the 9 particular bad opinions that you choose to highlight in your book?
Yeah, that was difficult because the list was a lot longer. One of the keys for me was, because this is a book for the general public, mm-hmm. I wanted good stories. And so the book it's really a book of stories. And I kind of sneak in a little bit of law in there, any of the law that someone who's not a lawyer needs to know. I sneak in, but it's really a book of stories. So I try to think about which cases had some compelling stories, but also which are the ones that have done the most damage, essentially, with the mix of cases that people have heard of, like Citizens United, or like Bush v. Gore, which ended the 2000 presidential election, and then some cases that people probably have never heard of, but have had also an outsized influence on the field. So that's where you get that 1983 case of Anderson versus Celebrezze, the 1992 case of Burdick versus Takushi about write-in voting. And that's a good example, both of a chapter that has a lot of fascinating stories. I tracked down Alan Burdick, who's still living in Hawaii, who brought this case, and got to interview him. The chapter has a story of murder. I'm not going to spoil it, but there's actually a murder that in there that is kind of discussing write-in voting. And but also that case has been cited by the Supreme Court a ton for the proposition that we're going to essentially trust states to run their elections as they want. So I try to have a mix of cases that have all had an outsized influence. Some, again, people have heard of, some most people have not, but all also have compelling stories to try to make it readable.
And I hope listeners are not misled by you and I, a couple of election geeks here, sort of getting into some of these weeds here. This is not a book for, it's also for law scholars, but it's also for, you know, regular human, actual human beings, voters, for just to sort of make that argument plain. I will note that chapter 6 on Bush v. Gore is actually titled "An Embarrassing Judicial Fart." So there you go. Hardly the law scholar type chapter head we might expect. Finally, Josh Douglas, you argue in the book that, quote, "We can no longer count on the Supreme Court to protect an equal right to vote for all. Voters are left with nowhere to turn to vindicate their rights. If that is the case, it raises at least two questions for me. A, are our elections fair, and why should we participate in them if not? And B, if we're left with nowhere to turn, well, where do we turn, and what can we do about it?" Josh?
Yeah, so on the first question, of course people should vote, because although it shouldn't take them a supermajority to, say, undo a severe partisan gerrymander, a map that's unfair, you know, supermajorities can overcome this. And it is ultimately, our democracy is for the voters, and it's up to us to elect pro-democracy individuals, whether they're Republicans, Democrats, or independents, or anyone in between. To me, we should have a litmus test of, are you pro-democracy? And this, in terms of the second question on solutions, so the conclusion is all about solutions. You know, I'm an optimistic person. I'm an optimist in general. I actually started, as you know, a podcast of my own called Democracy Optimist. So I didn't want to leave readers with all just doom and gloom. And so the conclusion offers a number of solutions. One is on court reform, and I discuss several mechanisms to reform the way the court operates. The other is actually what was kind of the beginning impetus of writing this book, where I discuss four principles of a grand election compromise that I think should be the starting point for any conversations about voting laws, and also could be a judicial test. You know, does this law, this voting rule, satisfy at least one of the principles of the grand election compromise? And does it violate any of them? And I know we're almost out of time, but I'll briefly go through them, which is that every eligible voter should have easy access to the ballot. The election system should be set up to deter fraud. Third, voters should be well educated. And fourth, the losing candidate should graciously accept defeat. These are things that I think, if you disagree with them, then I question your commitment to democracy. And that should be the starting place for all of our conversations about election rules.
Well, you know, Josh, I would agree with you, except that that would get about 50% of this country at this point to call you one of those radical leftist loose cannons we started with. Joshua A. Douglas, his work can be found at joshuaadouglas.com. He teaches election law at the University of Kentucky College of Law. You can find him on the Twitters at Joshua A. Douglas. And by the way, when you stop by his website at joshuaadouglas.com, you can also buy his newest book, The Court Versus the Voters, The Troubling Story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. Great speaking with you, Professor. Look forward to doing it again in the near future.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. All right, quick break. And we are back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. This is the Bradcast. Don't touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Hot enough for you yet?
Yes.
And summer is just getting started. And things are already terrible, as once again we discuss in our latest Green News Report.
We are playing Russian roulette with our planet.
May 2024 was the hottest May ever recorded, as the planet marks 12 straight months of unprecedented heat. Heat wave deaths in the U.S. hit a new record in 2023. Plus, the world's largest solar farm is now online.
Cool.
In China.
Of course. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
When they say that the seas will rise over the next 400 years, 1/8 of an inch, you know. Which means basically you have a little more beachfront property, okay?
Okay, no. Actually, no. It means you have a whole lot less beachfront property, and it's not an 1/8 of an inch, it's more like a foot. And why am I trying to reason with you? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen. Don't even get me started with that guy. I don't even know why we're bothering to play him anymore. Anyway, what do you have on today's report?
Well, first, a surge of disturbing new climate data.
Great.
May 2024 was the hottest May on record globally since record keeping began in the 1850s. Plus, a new milestone. All of the last 12 months have been the hottest 12 months ever recorded, driven by humanity's burning of fossil fuels. That's according to Europe's climate agency, Copernicus, whose director warned that summer 2024 will likely be remembered, quote, as comparatively cold.
Oy.
A different analysis from the United Nations Weather Agency
says Copernicus has it all wrong?
No, unfortunately. They calculate that there's now an 80% chance that average global temperatures will surpass the 1.5 degrees Celsius target laid out in the landmark Paris Climate Accord in at least one of the next 5 calendar years.
That's not good.
They say massive changes to Earth's ecosystems are more likely to kick in between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius of warming.
So it's about to get a whole lot worse?
It could. A third study finds that human greenhouse gas emissions are warming the planet at a record rate, with 92% of last year's heat caused by humans, with a minor contribution from El Nino. But a bit of good news, the scientists say there is no evidence yet that global warming itself is accelerating. Scientists from World Weather Attribution and others found that over the last year, man-made climate change added on average 26 additional days of extreme heat around the world.
Now I think I was enjoying listening to Donald Trump a little bit more.
Then you really won't like this. Here in the U.S., yes. A new AP analysis finds that in 2023, heat wave deaths set a new record. CDC data show that at least 2,300 people died from excessive heat last summer, likely an undercount. The majority of deaths were in Arizona, followed by Texas, Nevada, and Florida, all places that, in the past, used to be able to handle extreme heat.
2,300 heat deaths here in the U.S. alone over just last year.
Yes.
Wow.
In a hard-hitting speech marking World Environment Day this week, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres cited recent record-shattering extreme heat and flood disasters in India, Mexico, Brazil, and the U.S., and the growing global costs of climate damages, calling it, quote, the mother of all stealth taxes. Guterres warned that governments and the global business sector must slash emissions faster, by at least 9% a year, to avoid truly catastrophic consequences, saying, quote, we need an exit ramp off the highway to climate hell. Guterres called for a global ban on fossil fuel advertising, like the ban on tobacco ads, and shifting government subsidies from fossil fuels to renewable energy, and a global windfall profits tax on all fossil fuel companies.
He means business.
The battle for 1.5 degrees will be won or lost in the 2020s under the watch of leaders today.
Uh-oh.
It's climate crunch time. Meanwhile, the godfathers of climate chaos, the fossil fuel industry, rake in record profits, have shown relentless zeal for obstructing progress over decades. If you are not in the fast lane to clean energy transformation, you are driving your business into a dead end and taking us all with you.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, there is some progress. The world's largest solar farm came online this week in China. Truly massive, as large as New York City, built on barren desert land over an abandoned mine waste dumping site.
Wow.
China leads the world in building out solar energy. A recent UN International Energy Agency report found that last year alone, China deployed more solar capacity than the entire rest of the world combined.
Wow, as large as New York City?
Yes.
I'm still thinking about Guterres's call for that exit ramp.
Off the highway to climate hell.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I'm on the highway to hell.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the highway to hell.
Yes, we are. Very cool, though, by the way, about that Chinese
world's largest solar farm, for now.
Size of New York City.
Yeah.
And that after years of Republicans and Fox News telling us China was never going to do anything about climate change. It's a total ripoff if we do and they don't.
And, of course, what they're doing is they have done over these years is allow China to take the lead because they keep blocking U.S. domestic manufacturers from getting into the game. Biden has finally made that happen with the Inflation Reduction Act and other executive orders that he's passed through and agencies and regulations. But, you know, now the U.S. is behind China, and China is very likely to run and own the global clean energy market.
Well, as long as it's clean energy, I don't care who owns it at this point. Got to get out. Thank you very much to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks to my guest today, Professor Joshua A. Douglas of the University of Kentucky, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. That is made possible only by folks like you who hit one of those donate buttons or go to bradblog.com/donate. We haven't heard from Shell Oil since we've been on the air offering any support. All right. Well, then I guess it's up to you people. Please help. Bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am the Brad Blog. Hope to see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.